From the heartland of America and the gateway to the West, good morning, good evening, wherever you may be across the nation, around the world. I'm George Norrie. This is Coast to Coast AM. Emerging artist bumper music for the first couple hours tonight. Full information at coasttocoastam.com in our highlight carousel reel. Later tonight, the Diary of a Psychic. Here's what's happening. Now, there are reports, unconfirmed reports, coming out of Israel and Iran tonight, claiming that the Ayatollah Ali Khamenei, the 81-year-old Islamic regime's supreme leader in Iran, has died. An official announcement will not and has not been made until they say the transfer of power to his son, Mojaba Khamenei, are complete. That's all we have. We don't know if it's definitely confirmed, but these are stories coming out of Iran and Israel now. State health departments and governors across the country are finally being told by the U.S. Centers for Disease Control and Prevention and Operation Warp Speed how many doses of the coronavirus vaccine they will initially be receiving once the vaccine is authorized, and apparently it's not enough. Let's check in with Christian Wild, myheartbook.com, who's been following the coronavirus for us. Christian, what do you have for us?
Well, I'll tell you, George, a month ago, 40% surveyed nationally said they would not take the vaccine when available. However, since more positive information has raised confidence and a growing number of people are now more willing to become vaccinated, particularly when five current and ex-presidents, as well as Dr. Fauci himself, have collectively stated they would be the first to take the vaccine. Now, this new technology messenger, RNA, looking for emergency FDA approval in the next few days, is not new. It has been developed by legions of scientists over decades. And ironically, George, it comes into fruition when we as a nation need it most. The medical experts agree that this messenger RNA does not pose a threat. It's because it does not rely on a weakened or inactivated germ injected into our bodies as many previous vaccines have, and probably the major reason people are hesitant to take a vaccine.
Well, but how can you believe them, Christian? How can you believe them?
Will be useful going forward in treating many diseases and many viruses. And here's another plus. Vaccines using this new science have scored incredibly well on the FDA safety and efficacy charts. 90% and 94.5% when only a 50% score is required by the FDA. So how does this new science protect us from this killer virus? It's got to be explained. According to the CDC website, mRNA vaccines instruct our cells to produce a harmless piece of a special synthetic protein called a spike protein on the outside edge of the virus, and that in itself triggers an immune response to protect us against this and possibly other viruses. So why leading scientists and researchers, including Dr. Fauci, say this new vaccine for COVID is safe and effective? I think in the next few days, we are going to see a response from the FDA. And like you just said earlier, as hard as they are at producing, at work, talking about Pfizer, at producing the necessary number of doses, they only can do half.
They're not ready for it, Christian. But let me ask you this. How can you believe a pharmaceutical company when they are immune from prosecution and lawsuits?
Well, yeah, how can you believe anybody in today's world? Except to say, they're anxious to make money, and the sooner and the greater number they can produce, and we're talking millions and millions of cases of COVID around the world. India has a tremendous number of cases, and they're crying out for a vaccine also.
Well, there's just not enough, Christian. There's just not enough. Kristen's website, myheartbook.com. Well, in a couple hours, they're going to lock down California. More than 34 million people will be locked down. It's incredible. And small business owners are worried about the new California shutdown. This coming lockdown, they say, will pretty much put a lot of businesses out of business. And money is not something anyone wants to worry about during the holidays, right? In a year still ravaged by the coronavirus pandemic and its economic fallout, however, it appears that many will be struggling through most festive part of 2020. A survey finds that over 60% of the Americans say they're now living paycheck to paycheck as the year draws to a close. Many businesses, though, have been closing due to the COVID-19 pandemic, but fortune tellers appear to be doing quite well. So why are more and more people turning to psychics during this health crisis? In a world of uncertainty, people are looking for predictability. Let's check in with Catherine Austin Fitz. Catherine, something's got to be done. These lockdowns are going to shut down a lot of businesses permanently.
Right, but they're making a fortune for the billionaires and the large companies that are rolling all the sales up into,
right,
into their business. Here's the thing. Economies need facts and science to function. And, apologies to your recent speaker, but what he was talking about was not facts and not science. It's a bunch of bull. And the reality is, if you pay your taxes to a government that shuts down your business so the big corporations can get the sales. You know, this is the most magical virus, George, because it only attacks businesses. You know, I literally watched someone from one of the major shriek-a-meter media outlets saying that this virus was not safe when it was in a church or a small business, but it was safe when it was in a big box store. So we're watching economic warfare on a scale that has never yet been delivered to the whole planet, but here it is. So this is something you've been covering for years. This is economic warfare. This is not an economic problem. This is a war problem. This is World War III. And the question is, are we going to be free or are we going to be slaves? And if we, you know, if we allow our bodies to be poisoned by what's coming, we will be slaves.
Well, it's unfortunate to be sure. Catherine, we're going to check in with you later on this week and get some more updates from you because it's a tough situation. SpaceX has launched an uncrewed spacecraft on a cargo-carrying mission to the International Space Station. The Dragon spacecraft and Falcon 9 rocket lifted off from Kennedy Space Center's launch pad at 11:17 a.m. on Sunday Eastern Time. Japan has retrieved a capsule of asteroid dust from Australia's remote outback after a six-year mission that may help uncover more about the origins of the planets and water. The mission of the Japanese spacecraft, the Hayabusa 2, spotlights Asia's growing role in space exploration with a Chinese robotic vehicle collecting lunar samples last week for the first time since the 1970s. It's truly remarkable. Now, here's something we cannot confirm yet. It's not the story yet about the Iran leader. That's still unconfirmed that he has died at the age of 81, but that's got some teeth to it. There was a story breaking today on Facebook of all places, that says in Buckeye, small town in Arizona, in Maricopa County, Sheriff's Department, the Police Department of Buckeye, and ATF, Alcohol, Tobacco, and Firearms agents, found a bus that was abandoned on a highway road. The plates were from Nevada, dated 2006. There was nobody in the bus. But when they went to the back of the bus, they found voting machines in there, a number of them. Now, we're trying to confirm this story, and some departments are baffled, but it happened apparently in Buckeye, a small town in Arizona. If anybody picks up any more information on that, just email me at george@coasttocoastam.com. Up next, the nature of demons and demonic possession, next on Coast to Coast AM. And welcome back to Coast, George Norrie with you. We're going to have two special guests for you this hour. Each will be with us for a half hour. The first guest is James Anito. He began researching and investigating very mysterious occurrences while in his mid-teens. It was during the pursuit of these interests that he received his calling to serve in the Holy Ministry. Ordained a deacon in the United States Old Catholic Church, James is a seminarian and theologian. In 2016, he founded the Dominion Ministry, which is an outreach and networking organization. He has become established as a public speaker, giving testimonials on his unique experiences with paranormal investigations, in particular, personal encounters with what may be considered demonic. James, welcome to the program. It's good to have you here tonight.
Well, thank you very much, and good evening to all your listeners. Good evening to you.
Let's go back to when you were in the teens. What happened to get you into all of this?
Oh, well, you know, I think you always hear individuals with similar situations having a haunting. But basically, I was just very rebellious to religion and the idea of God and the idea of spirits. And, you know, of course, watched all these shows and read all these books by some of the greats. And decided to get into it myself. You know, I think you have to physically see something to be able to explore something. So it was my wanting to learn if there is an afterlife. And basically, from being rebellious in belief through a lot of traumatic experiences that happened to me emotionally as a child, you know, I really wanted to seek the answer, does God exist? Does spirits exist? And it was a rabbit hole that kind of swallowed me whole as a young kid.
Now, would you consider yourself a demonologist?
Well, yeah. I study and have expounded on those studies for almost 10-plus years, so I definitely would have to say that would be my leaning, yes, and most people would qualify me to be a demonologist.
Can you go to school to become a demonologist, James?
Well, there is no specific band camp or schooling, so to say. You know, the Catholic Church does have courses that it does enable some of its priests that are going through the process to become an exorcist to take courses. But specifically, it's more of a self-learning aspect of study. And of course, in the same token, there are people that are very well respected from many different Christian churches, even non-Christian churches, that study demonology, and you can become mentored under them. And, you know, the second part of the guest tonight, that's part of duodemonology, which is the research and lecture unit that I am comprised of with Carl Johnson. You know, he was my mentor. You know, he investigated claims for 47 years. And I was fortunate to meet him and learn from him as well.
I've had a few guests on over the years, James, who do not believe in demons, and I've told them on the air, I wouldn't go in that direction, folks. These things are real, and they're not friendly.
Oh, yeah, most certainly. I think, you know, a lot of people have tried to tell me the same thing, and I'm a big person when it comes to not jumping to the conclusion of the paranormal, but I've seen things that psychiatrists, psychotherapists, psychologists have had their eyes on, their hands on, been involved with those situations, and nomenclature such as the DSM-5 can't claim these things, and there has been no medical or scientific explanation. Some of the circumstances that I've been a part of. So I would definitely have to lean towards that demons exist as well. Rare, but they exist.
Are demons horrible humans who died and their souls continue in a demonic form? What are they?
Well, in literature sense, you know, the ideologies of demons have been around since most civilizations have had a concept of faith or religion. You know, Hinduism, 4,400 years old, their gods fought demons all the time. So in some form of fashion, they are what we can lean towards with what we understand to this day, because the paranormal is not, you know, it's a pseudoscience for many people. And one thing that we can lean towards is that they are a non-physical being, aka inhuman, and they are a pure spirit. They've never had a body. and they never existed and walked this plane of existence like we do as humans. So in some form of fashion, no, a demon would not be a very bad human that passed away. It would be something that predates human civilization and are very, very old and very well versed in the concepts of humanity and the sociology of humanity, but predate our civilization.
What do they want, James? What do they want with us?
Well, if we follow the guidelines of what has been presented to us and what, of course, Carl and myself have seen, of course, it is to shame us. You know, if you look at the bylaws of Scripture, and you know, I'm not a very lean person towards that all the time because there's so many more things you can look at, but they just want to basically shame us. They basically want to show us that our faith can be twisted, manipulated, and I think that at points in times that our eagerness to track these things, the eagerness of pride that we have sometimes, you know, I think that our ego gets the best of us, and there's these things, these forces out there that put us back into our place. You know, I think a lot of people have the concept that a demon is allowed by a higher power because it really is the true test of faith. If mm-hmm. you have this thing that is brought into your life, are you going to be able to overcome it? It's a trial and a tribulation that we face every day, basically, in physical formats or a mental aspect. But this is a whole spiritual trials and tribulation. This is, can you get through this? Is your power of faith able to overcome this? Can you believe in God? Can you believe in the positivity of this world? And I think they exist in that kind of format. I don't know why, of course, they're allowed to exist. I think that, you know, if everything is good and life is great, you know, they shouldn't. But I can also understand why they do.
Do they worship Satan, James?
Well, that's hard because, you know, I'm at a point where, you know, a lot of demons are metaphorical. You know, of course, there's always a truth from any folklore or myth. There's always that one part of truth that comes from it or where it comes from. So, you know, of course, the idea of Satan, Lucifer, you know, of course, Lucifer, you know, fell from the grace of God in Scripture, and that was because of pride. So do they really beckon to his name? You know, some would say yes, but if you really think of why these fallen angels supposedly had fell, it was pride, and it was to follow Satan. But in that same tone, if they're evil, if we've observed evil people in our lives, you know, in the sociology of human civilization, you know, evil people turn on each other. It's only for a short time mm-hmm. that they are cohorts and they work together, but they always seem to turn on each other. Look at mafias, look at any other organization. You know, some say demonologies have a hierarchy. If there's this evil hierarchy, they're definitely going to rebel against each other. So do they specifically follow Satan? That could be a tough answer. I definitely don't think so. I think there's some form of fashion of the way these things are ranked in power or in whatever kind of species or being they are. But I don't think they listen to the same ways as we do, like a government, a law.
Are you afraid of demons at all, James? Do they bother you?
Well, you know, you always have to have that little ability to understand and swallow things that you're about to see. I wouldn't say I fear them. Of course, you're always mindful of the circumstances, the situations you're going to be in. You know, I have a child, so I always have to be mentally, spiritually active. I attempt to be a good person. You know, of course, it's hard to be in this world sometimes, but sure. I always attempt to be a good person. I smile every day. So if you fear, then you give, of course, these fears to the enemy what they want. So I'm always cautious is a better word. I'm cautious, but in the same token, I have my head on my shoulders. And I think that's, if especially dabbling in this and studying it and being active in an applied state, then you always have to stay motivated and not give them what they want. You know, these are parasitical entities. they feed off the fear. They feed off these emotions, so you can't give it to them, especially if you're in this line of work.
Good point. James Anito's websites are linked up at coasttocoastam.com. Next up, Carl Johnson, the demonologist, joins us, and James and Carl will join us in the next hour for phone calls here on Coast to Coast AM. So get ready for all of that. And again, just go to our website, coasttocoastam.com. All their information is listed there. We're talking about demons right now. In a moment, Carl Johnson, demonologist, joins us, and then both will be joined. James will come back with Carl next hour to take your phone calls as we talk about demons. And believe me, they are out there in droves right about now. And welcome back to Coast, George Norrie with you. Let me tell you about Carl Johnson, has been investigating reports of strange phenomena for the past 47-plus years, beginning with his association with the noted ghost-hunting couple, the incredible couple, the late Ed and Lorraine Warren, as members of a team based on Rhode Island College. Carl and his identical twin brother, Keith, were called in to investigate the Perrone family situation in Harrisville, Rhode Island, during the August and September of 1973 event, and they alerted the Warrens to that situation. 40 years later, this inspired a motion picture entitled, as you will know, The Conjuring. Specializing as a demonologist, Carl continues his exploration of the supernatural through his research and the unit called the Panorama Paranormal. Hello, Carl. Welcome to the program.
Hello, and it's good to be with your program.
You too, my friend. And you had an opportunity to work with the best people, the Ed and Lorraine
Warren. Notables and some giants in the field of paranormal research and exploration.
That is fantastic. How did you get a hold of them? How did that all start?
Well, I attended a lecture at Rhode Island College in Providence, Rhode Island, and the guest speakers were the famed ghost hunting couple, Ed and Lorraine Warren. I remember sitting out there, this goes back to probably when you were a little boy, and it's, 1972, and I was 17 years of age, and I remember sitting out there listening to Ed Warren speak, and I said to myself, that's who I want to be when I grow up. I want to do what he's doing. And actually, it was an audience participation. He actually called me up on the stage, and I got to know the Warrens. And that evening, I was invited to join a group based at Rhode Island College called PIRO, Parapsychology Investigatory and Research Organization. And they thought I was pretty impressive, so they invited me to join their group. Now, we'd investigated exterior settings, you know, gone to some remarkable places in Rhode Island, saw some strange phenomenon, heard phenomena. But we wanted to investigate residences, go to people's haunted houses. To that effect, my twin brother placed an ad in a local periodical advertising our group and saying we do not charge for investigating a house, just want to get to the bottom of things. And 3 weeks to the date, after that ad was published, we were contacted by a Mrs. Carolyn Perrin, who lived in Harrisville, Rhode Island. And we spoke with her at length, and she wanted us to come and investigate their house where they had some strange happenings. And we went there and found it quite interesting. Many things happened that first day we were there. And so we made a couple of visitations, and the family really did have what we'd consider a severe haunting. So I decided to contact Ed and Lorraine Warren, with whom I had become acquainted in those ensuing months. Mm-hmm. It is not that our team felt we were in over our heads. Never did we feel that. We just thought that it would be nice to consult the Warrens and benefit from their vast experience. So I remember being on the phone with Edward Warren, and he volunteered them to come to the house. And so we, the Warrens actually came there. Yeah. And, I was just getting a message here.
Okay.
Yeah, so the Warrens came to the house, and we went through, and I helped give the tour and all that. And so they became involved in the investigation, which I thought was going to be a collaboration. But then we didn't hear from the Perrin family, Roger and Carolyn, for the next couple of weeks. We figured that the case was being dealt with. It had either become severe, and the Warrens were interceding, or perhaps everything was resolved and they didn't need any more investigating. But then Mrs. Perrin called me, and I'd been in daily touch with her for some time until that two-week period. And Mrs. Perrin called me and said that, she thanked me, but said that the Warrens had told them, Roger and Carolyn, the homeowners, that the only way they could be of any assistance is if they were the only paranormalist involved, if they were only the only ghost hunters there and only paranormal investigators, that we were just a bunch of college kids and we couldn't do any good for them. So that's how we lost out on that case. But we had it for a couple of months.
Well, that's amazing, Carl, what you were able to do. And I've got to tell you, The Conjuring, the movie came out, I believe, 2013. And that still scares so many people when that, you know, pops up. And, you know, you were the developer, basically, of this. It was your concept of what happened. And it was just truly remarkable. Tell us this. When the movie came out, how close did it echo what was going on in your life?
Oh, I'm glad you asked me that. Let's see. Well, the movie was, I resisted seeing the movie because I thought it would be fictionalized and, you know, what could I see in it? You know, it might be a little frustrating since that had originally been our case. And my brother urged me to see it. He wanted to get some of the original investigating team together to see the motion picture The Conjuring. And I must say, I thoroughly enjoyed the movie.
It was a great movie. Great movie.
It was. It's entertaining. It's, you know, shock a minute. It warms you to the family. I didn't think there was a lot of character development with you know, how they portrayed the family, but they're favorably represented. Now, very little of the movie is that true to life, really.
Okay.
The basic facts are there. There was a family that, you know, the Perron family that resided in Harrisville, Rhode Island, in a 1736 farmhouse. They were experiencing a haunting, and the Warrens came and interceded. And then somewhere around there, our team was never mentioned in it, of course. But there is a scene where Carolyn Perron is reaching out for help, and she goes to a lecture hall where the Warrens are appearing, portrayed by Patrick Wilson and Vera Farmiga, Ed and Lorraine Warren. Now, if you see that scene, and actually the elegant Lorraine Warren has a cameo appearance in that scene. She's sitting out in the audience with her daughter Judy, and, you know, they don't name her, but we recognize her as the real-life Lorraine. And the Warrens are shown lecturing. If you see the actors portraying the Warrens there, it's then you've seen the Warrens, because that is very much how they were. It's like watching Ed and Lorraine lecture if you see that scene. And it was very nostalgic for me.
Does Hollywood, Carl, make demons worse than they really are?
I don't know if it makes them worse, but it makes them easier to understand, because they portray them as larger than life, and something you can see, and something more tangible than they really are. The demons are actually subtle. You may not recognize them as such right away. They are, in motion pictures, they're presented in more dramatic terms, so that the audience can understand and be scared by them. But demons are real, of that I am convinced. So, some of the activity that is portrayed in the movie The Conjuring, of course, did occur, you know, but it's made very succinct, and the storyline is quite inaccurate, the way the Warrens, you know, like, learned about the situation there. But still, an entertaining film. The interior of the house looks very much like it really does, like it did, and it does now. You know, and they were fascinating people.
Oh, my God, absolutely. And they were into this in a big way. Now, you're a demonologist. Exactly what is a demonologist? What do you do?
Well, that's not exactly my day job. I don't get paid for it unless I'm, you know, giving a lecture. A demonologist is someone who conducts a systematic study of the lore and cultural tradition of wicked spirits. So basically, looks for devils and demons and researches them. Now, I am an applied demonologist, as is James Anito. That means we will go out into the field and address cases that are brought to our attention. But basically, a demonologist who studies that lore is someone who makes a study of demons, as they are referred to in Western culture. So.
Let me ask you this, though. Have you ever been attacked doing what you do?
Yes.
Really? What happened?
Yes, I have been. Oh,
just tempered the language. Make sure you're on radio, so don't tell us what the demon said.
I know they had a lot of vulgarities there.
Yeah, absolutely.
Demons are notoriously impolite and inconvenient. You really can't go into what they utter. But there have been times I have received welts and scratches that could not be explained. Fairly superficial, but you know, they came from an unseen source, and I know they were not psychosomatic in me. I've had objects thrown at me, hurled at me, but never with any injury, which is strange.
You've been lucky.
Objects have flown my way. And most notably, what probably will segue into another answer to another question, is when I addressed what I determined to be a true demonic case, a case of demonic possession in Providence, Rhode Island, many years ago. And that was authentic, yes. And I was in real danger at times because of the subject, who was a 14-year-old boy, but going under these wild and unpredictable fits where his personality would change. Actually, his personality seemed subjugated and taken over by something else, something invasive. And yeah, I didn't know what to expect minute to minute. It was my first actual demonic situation, demonic case. And that is when I first became referred to as a demonologist. So cut my teeth on that one.
Were you ever accused of being a Satanist?
Yes, with some merit, because I did practice ritual magic, and it was called Luciferian.
Were you trying to summon up the devil and stuff like that?
Not exactly that, no. It's probably a poor term to apply to my...
Yeah, I mean, I don't see you as an evil guy at all, Carl.
No, I'm not now, and I wasn't then. But Ed and Lorraine Warren had heard I was into ritual magic, and I called myself a Luciferian. So that had to be evil. So they wanted to film one of my rituals, which I consented. I had good relations with them at the time. I consented to that. And they used it as part of their lecture. And I remember Edward Warren asking me, so, well, where's your animal? I said, well, we have a beagle upstairs. He said, no, where's your sacrifice? I said, I don't do that. I don't sacrifice animals. He said, well, isn't there going to be some bloodletting? I said, no, I'm sorry to disappoint, but nothing quite that dramatic. You know, but understandably, people had a misconception of that when you have a, you know, you call yourself a Luciferian, then people are going to think you're into, you know,
the black mass and all that stuff.
Yeah, they wanted a black mass, but they didn't have one. they didn't get to film that.
Who is Lucifer, as far as you're concerned?
Lucifer is a symbol. Lucifer is a name applied to what can be a force of nature if summoned. But it was a Roman god of light and of sunrise. In fact, the planet Venus in the morning when it rises, that is called Lucifer, colloquially. In the 19th century and 18th centuries, you would call the star in the morning star, which is actually the planet Venus, that would be called Lucifer because it brought in the light. Lucifera, light bearer, you know. And that was a symbol of rebellion, a symbol of magical force. But I never saw it as connoted with anything evil. Yeah, I mean, what is evil? Evil is anti-life. Evil is being inconvenient. Evil for evil's sake is irrational. So I was never that.
Are you an exorcist, too?
Oh, I have been an unintentional exorcist. I'm not qualified to be an exorcist. You know, you're referring to the Ritualis Romano, you know, which actually is a formal Catholic rite where the demon is cast out forcibly. I have participated and conducted expulsions where a spirit is cast out, and I did that under emergency conditions where somebody had to act, and I commanded the spirit to leave, which is kind of like, one could say it's overstepping my bounds, but something had to be done at the time. And so it was with that case when the subject was a 14-year-old boy, and he was being taken over. I knew somebody had to act, and there was not a priest present, so I did, and I've done that several times. It's where I prayerfully and with some concentration and standing my ground, of course, and always having examined the psychological aspects.
I'm in St. Louis right now, Carl, where the exorcism of that little boy from Baltimore occurred that was based on the movie The Exorcist, and then they shut down the hospital where they had the little boy in that room. It was since closed and demolished, but they sold off all the furniture, and we started hearing stories that the furniture that was sold to individuals might have had some kind of demon attached to it because they were having weird things happen to themselves, the people who bought the stuff.
Yes, under extreme conditions, that I think that can happen. We don't know what principle upon that, which that works, but sometimes people can have haunted objects, and they run into all kinds of trouble because of that. Now, that was a genuine case of spiritual possession. And when I say genuine, I'm not decrying the psychological ramifications, because every demonic case I have heard of or participated in, intervened in, there was always some unresolved trauma or some seriously unresolved conflict, you know, that had incited the haunting. Something went wrong with the person's mind, with their background. But it can lead to genuine paranormal phenomena. And so it was with the case Robbie. You know, the exorcist, as you said, The Exorcist was predicated on a real-life story. A lot of people don't know that about The Exorcist, but there was the truth behind that. And demonic possession is similar. That's where they got their data from, William Peter Blatty, who authored the book The Exorcist and was the consultant on the movie. Real-life cases of exorcism that he put together, including Robbie. Many of those things do happen. In Hollywood portrayal, they tend to be like happen more rapidly and concise, because to have a good story, you need a beginning, the drama in the middle, and either everybody is lost or the situation is somehow resolved. You need a solid start, story, and ending. And real life isn't always like that. Sometimes these situations go on for months or years. But The Exorcist remains one of my favorite movies.
It's a great movie. Why is there so much evil in the world, Carl? This kind of evil?
Because the world is filled with people, and I think demons proceed from people. Now, we don't know. We're basically dealing with the great unknown. I know there are beings that are non-physical. I wouldn't even call them creatures. They're not physical. They can appear, they can manifest, and people have seen them. I have a photograph of one. I can't, of course, display it to you right now, of what I think is a demonic visage, a face of a demon. And
they're not friendly-looking, are they?
No, they're never really wholesome. There's something wrong. It's almost like we're being warned about them. Don't tread here. Because it's a horrific image, this demonic face I have in the photograph. So they never appear whole or wholesome. A demon can, if it appears, which is rare, if somebody sees them, and it's generally a child that sees them, there's always something wrong. They're deformed somehow. They're missing a body part. They don't appear as whole human beings.
Yeah.
I remember one situation. It was in Brooklyn, New York, and the subject was a 14-year-old girl. And she had this nice lady visit her at night. Then during one of these visitations, that she became friendly with this ghostly form, and didn't, you know, thought it was a good fairy.
Sure. Got tricked.
Yes, it was deceptive. The lady apparition smiled, and the little girl said, but she wasn't. She was crying. She said, but she wasn't friendly anymore.
Oh,
her teeth were pointed, and she didn't have eyes. So the demon soon revealed itself as such.
They kind of do that to get into your life, and then they do what they do.
Oh, yeah. I mean, a child will trust when she sees a nice lady come into her room. You know, I mean, an adult would be horrified by that, but she thought it was a friendly spirit, like a good fairy, until about probably the second, maybe third visitation, it revealed itself as not so friendly and actually had long family.
And then she realized it. Carl, stay with us. We're going to get James back on the line with you, and for both of you, we'll take phone calls next hour. So get ready to make the calls as we talk about demons, folks. Questions, stories, share them with us. Here's our next emerging artist, Super and Star from Los Angeles.